Basically, the format is just, we're just going to talk. It's, okay. It's very conversational.
I'll just have to think of a passage that doesn't have A, swearing, or B, something so disturbing that it will...
Well, this is an erotica show. Did I mention that? This is all erotica. Take off your shirts. Let's do it.
Yeah.
The word haunting is often overused in describing books, but for Dan Shaun, and that's C-H-A-O-N, Shaun, his new novel, Ill Will, haunting is a beautiful word. The book is gloriously haunting. It's darkly beautiful, a journey into grief and paranoia and murder. Dan Shaun is the author of the novels You Remind Me of Me and Await Your Reply, along with the short story collections Among the Missing and Stay Awake. His new novel is brilliant, and he's on tour right now discussing it. And we are going to be talking today on The Write-Up about heartache, dark laughter, and leaning toward nightmare logic. Thanks for joining us on The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I'm Owen Edgerton, and our guest today is Dan Shaun. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Write-Up, a KUT-produced podcast where we talk to writers about their works and their lives behind their works. And today we're talking with novelist and short story writer Dan Shaun. I'm so glad that you're here, Dan. Thank you for being here. And congratulations, we're talking about your new novel, Ill Will, which is wonderfully disturbing, terribly frightening. It was a fantastic book to be reading right before I went to sleep because I got to have nightmares all night long. It was like an extended version of the book. A beautiful book, and in so many ways, I think the word haunting is used so often to describe books, but this is one of the most haunting novels I've ever experienced.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I wanted to ask you about it. I don't want to give too much away of the book because it is a mystery, it is a thriller, but there's so many entry points into it. There's so many different stories. A grieving husband who becomes entrapped in a conspiracy theory. He's dealing with his own children's growing up and leaving the house. But there's so many aspects of memory, of wrongful imprisonment, of different narratives changing from different point of views. I was wondering, what was your entry point when you started writing this? What was the trigger that made this an exciting and tasty narrative to enter into?
Well, I mean, I guess I started out with a story that my brother-in-law told me about 10 years ago, which had to do with a series of drowning deaths that happened at colleges in Wisconsin. My brother-in-law and some of his friends lost one of their classmates who left a bar, disappeared, and then ended up in a local river. And they firmly believed that there was something mysterious going on. Meanwhile, the police were like, this is death by misadventure. Don't get drunk and walk around the river. And that idea of this sort of growing urban legend was really interesting to me. Thought about it a lot, then couldn't figure out what I wanted to do with it, so I put it in a drawer. And then when I started writing this book, it came up again in my mind. It seemed connected to some of the other weird things that were going on in this book. So I guess it's a book that has pieces that are very old.
Oh, I see.
And then, really a lot of the book, the spine of it has to do with this idea that I had of somebody who's in a very happy place in their life, and then slowly all of the things that they thought were great about their life begin to slip away very, very rapidly.
Yes.
And you slowly realize that this person did not have a really balanced idea of what their life really was.
Right.
That they were in denial about a lot of things.
I think, actually, with all the disturbing imagery and the disturbing circumstances, I think what I found most disturbing was that aspect, the idea that all the things that I cherish and understand as my life, as my happy life, could so quickly fall away, and then I would realize I am not the person that I had hoped I was.
Right.
I think that's
everybody's fear.
Yeah.
That what you think is yourself is not yourself.
Yeah.
And that what other people think about you may be completely different from what you believe they think about you.
Right. And do we want to know that?
No, we don't.
I mean, that is a big part of this book is, do we want to remember the truth? Wouldn't it be nicer just to have the narratives that feel comfortable? There's a great a series or a moment in the book where one of the characters is reading a letter that his wife had received, and there's the great question of, do I want to know what's in this letter? Is it going to tell me things that I will that will destroy my own narrative?
Right. And I guess it's not a spoiler to say that this is the type of guy that decides in the end to throw that letter away rather than read it.
That was such a moment for me. I was like wondering, like, is he going to, and what would I do? You know, my first inclination is like, oh, I would read it. I'm curious. I would have to know, no matter how disturbing. But
I guess that's one of the core questions of the novel is, do we really want self-knowledge?
Right.
And how and what's the price that we pay for it?
Yeah, there was a great quote from the psychiatrist Lenore Terre.
Yeah.
That you reference. There are whole lives built around trying not to remember something.
Yeah.
That struck me as so very true. And that kind of leads me to the next thing. It seems there for writers such as yourself, there are whole careers that are built on trying to remember something. That you seem to have done like a really wonderful job of going to the darkest places of your own life and exploring aspects of just what it means to be alive.
Right. And I guess it's not because I'm necessarily a dark person in my daily life.
Yeah.
I think I'm generally a pretty happy guy. I mean, I've had some terrible things happen in my life. But I find that in some ways, and this has always been the case for me, even when I was a little kid, I loved horror movies, even though I was a really scared kid.
Yeah.
And I think there's a kind of dialysis that happens in writing this kind of stuff and in reading it. You get to work out some of these things and maybe come out better off on the other side. I mean, when I leave a horror movie, I always have a skip in my step.
Yeah. No, I'm the same way. I love horror movies. I find them invigorating. And there's something – I saw someone introduce Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like an encore screening of it. And he said, when I was a kid, this was the first time – like everyone had told me how safe the world was and how things have happy endings. And finally, it's like, oh, shit, horrible things happen to good people. And this
right.
movie said it.
But kids know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's why they want to read fairy tales, why fairy tales are important to them, because they know that in their hearts. And even if they are safe, I think the experience of experiencing these ideas that have come up, like, yeah, my dad might abandon me in the woods and I'll find a witch and she'll want to eat me. I mean, that is a metaphor for things that kids really think about.
Right, right. And those fears are real fears, and to pretend that they're not is maybe even scarier.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or more dangerous.
Yeah. More dangerous indeed. I love that you love horror movies. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm a big consumer. so, yeah. And I'm just speaking of horror movies, I really love Follow. So,
oh, my
yeah.
gosh. Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate that. One of the things I was kind of fascinated to about what happens in this book and the whole conspiracy theory or urban legend and the case that you were talking about the drowned college student. It is the idea of trying to find meaning where perhaps there is no meaning. And that seems that is another big theme that runs through this book.
Right, right. I think there's an early passage where Dustin, my main character, the psychologist, talks about how constellations are not a real thing. How
yeah.
you know they're actually these dots in the sky are not on one dimension; they're on three dimensions. So what we put together as Pisces or Gemini or whatever is really just an invention.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a kind of necessary thing for the human mind. I mean, we can't live in a world of complete randomness, I don't think.
Right.
And I don't think the book is necessarily being critical of that urge. It's just sort of making us aware of the way in which our lives are constructed out of random bits,
mm-hmm.
or our life story is you know, we live hundreds of thousands of hours, but the only hours that we pick as our life story are the ones that fit together in a logical way.
Mm, yeah. And I suppose the constellations look different from where you're standing as well. So,
sure.
even if there are certain facts, if you're standing on one side of them or another side of them, they tell or draw a different picture.
Right, right.
And there is something, though, when you know you said that the police officers in that original story that your brother-in-law shared with you said it's just accidental death. Was that the term?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I imagine how that's just – there's so much dissatisfaction when you hear that. Like that doesn't do anything. If someone tells me my friend, my loved one, their death meant nothing. It was an
right.
accident. There was no villain. There was no purpose.
That, right.
How do we accept that?
Right. I mean, I think there was a police chief that had a kind of moralistic view of it. He said, "If there's a serial killer, it's binge drinking," which you know, of course, college students would shake their fist at him and
yeah.
be like, "We hate you for that." But I mean, I think even he took what was essentially an accident. And tried to make meaning out of it, tried to make a moral out of it.
Yeah. That always strikes me. I'm a big fan of the Book of Job.
Mm-hmm. I hate that book.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
It's overrated. Just watch the movie.
Right. That was one of the biblical books that always really troubled me. My grandmother had a really horrifying picture book of, Bible stories. And Job was one of them.
Oh no! It's like a kid's
version of Job.
The picture book.
I mean, the other one was Noah, where there's like you see Noah standing on the ark, and he's looking down at all the people who are drowning, and there's this woman on like a little island holding a baby and sort of raising her hand towards Noah, and he's just frowning and shaking his head. And I always thought that doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, right.
But, Old Testament God was not necessarily all about, fairness.
No, it wasn't. But, like, in Job, which, like, one of the things that's fascinating in Job is you have Job at one point say, look, what I find most awful about this is not the boils and the death of my children and everything else. It's the fact that I know I'm innocent. If you could show me, please tell me how I'm guilty. Because if I'm guilty, at least I kind of deserve this. At least it makes sense. But if I know I'm innocent, then this is just random.
Right.
And that's much more frightening.
Yeah. I don't think there's anybody that's innocent in Ill Will.
No.
But one of the things that I discovered as I was writing was that my sympathies kept shifting and my sense of like the levels of innocence,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's no pure innocence and no pure guilt in this book. There's some people who have done super bad things, like the adopted brother, Rusty,
yeah.
was a really abusive older brother. But the amount of suffering that he undergoes is sort of disproportionate to what he did, I think. And so I found myself, like, when I was finally writing from his perspective, feeling super sympathetic to him in a weird way that I hadn't before when I was writing from his younger brother's perspective.
Yeah. Actually, that's one of my favorite portions of the book is when we get into his point of view, and his voice is so clear and so humanized. That there's a fantastic like juxtaposition of voices throughout this book. I would love you to actually comment a little bit of how you were able to do that. Not only that you had characters who perceived the world or perceived the past in different ways, had different narratives, but also just had, they were such at different emotional places. Like, how did you dive into each of those voices so fully?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hard thing to know how to describe. And I think the closest that I can get is that, I really wanted to enter into these consciousnesses,
mm-hmm.
with a kind of a trusting heart. And I mean, I feel like you're an improv guy, right?
Yeah.
And there's a kind of dive that you take into a character where you have to get into kind of an open and almost self-hypnotized state.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure how that happens, except that it happens almost automatically. And it's a kind of free writing. It's a kind of improv that you're doing. And then the more you're in it, the more you're able to inhabit the character.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you know, like having some kind of touchstone is super important. Like there's a character in one of my favorite characters is Dustin's son Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was complicated because he's a teenage heroin addict, which I've never been, and I don't know any teenage heroin addicts. But you know, the touchstone for me was my relationship with my son, and he was reading this as it was going along and kind of giving me feedback, and so it was like this collaborative thing that we were doing in creating this character. But it was a very strange process because I felt myself sort of using pieces of our relationship, using pieces of our lives as sort of like the seed or the kernel for that kid, and also seeing myself in a really different way when I was, you know, like thinking about him and thinking about his experience, and it was a super intense process for me.
Gosh, I can imagine. You know, that there is something about the dream aspect we're talking about where I find this in my own writing as well. And it's like when you have a dream, and in your dream there are elements from your life showing up.
Absolutely.
But they don't make sense. Or they're, you know, there's your gym coach from eighth grade, but he's suddenly, you know, making out with your mom for some reason, and things that never happened. And
right. Right. And I think, you know, what we're accessing is a part of our brain that's not verbal, but is, you know, like acts in images and feeling and in music to some extent.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we can have, I mean, you know, you, every time you hear an author say the characters took on a life of their own, you're like, yeah, that's stupid. But it's not.
It's not.
It's real. It really happens. It's just that we don't have words for what that is. I think the closest that most people have that experience is when they're kids and when they're playing.
Yeah.
Right? When they're playing pretend. I mean, you watch kids like sitting at the breakfast table and suddenly two pieces of bacon are having a conversation. And, you know, it's not like they've outlined that conversation.
Right.
It's happening straight out of nowhere. And suddenly the bacon are fighting or there's some drama with the two pieces of bacon. And the kid is totally engaged. And they're doing it without thinking about it. And I feel like that's what happens when you're doing improv or when you're writing or when you're, you know, like playing music, people talk about this zone.
Yeah.
And I think that there is such a thing and that it's a real thing. It's not mystical necessarily. It's just accessing a part of your brain that you don't access in your conscious life, yeah. Which is, I guess, another thing that this novel's about.
Yeah. Yeah. It most certainly is. You know, let me ask you this then. It's interesting. You were talking about the intensity of writing the teenage son, Aaron, and discussing it with your own son. I was recently talking to George Saunders about his novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, and talking about grief and how he describes grief, especially the passages which are the president contemplating the death of his son. And I asked him, I said, gosh, you know, that must have been so difficult, you being a father yourself. And he said, no, I don't go there. I don't feel as a writer I have to feel what the characters are feeling. I have to imagine it in that sort of way. And it was sort of an interesting perspective. I wonder how you feel. For me, I do have to sort of fall into that.
I always feel like I have to have some kind of emotional connection to the world that I'm writing in. And, you know, if I'm not like shedding a few tears over something by the time I'm finished, I feel like I haven't done my job.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like, particularly in like when it comes to like the death of a loved one, that's something that for most people you can't help but rehearse.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, as a young father, I was the primary caretaker for my two kids and would constantly go through those scenarios like, oh my God, what if he steps out onto this part? And, you know, so the, you know, that's why we're like barricading things and, you know, leaving the electrical plug things in till they're like 20.
Right.
And so on and so forth. Cause you have those fantasies and they come unbidden. You don't want them. But I think they're just part of how you, process love, right? Because love, for whatever reason, has to have its corollary, which is grief. I think grief is the corollary for love, not hate.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. And I think maybe, funny enough, it goes back to horror movies too, that there is something of like, let me imagine the worst thing possible. Because if I can shine a light in that part of the world, in that part of my nightmares, it's going to make me feel a little bit safer.
Right.
So let me imagine the worst thing happening with my kids, because I do the same thing, you know. And my wife is like, why would you think about that? I'm like, so that I can shine a light on it.
Right. Yeah, there's actually a lot of articles about this syndrome in like, you know, like the mommy internet. Mm-hmm. My sister is has two young girls, and she's constantly posting things on Facebook from mommy internet. And there's all these articles about, you know, what do I do when I'm having all these fantasies about the death of my children? How can I stop them?
Oh, my.
So you're not alone.
Good. Thank you. I just write about them. we're talking to Dan Shaun about his novel, Ill Will. Let me ask you, with Ill Will, we're talking about all these aspects about your life and how it fits into it. Of course, I know that you, like Rusty is a character in a book who was adopted, and you were adopted.
Yeah.
I know that you lost your wife to cancer,
mm-hmm.
and like Dustin, the character in the novel. And I know you have two teenage sons.
Right. They're not teenagers anymore.
Oh,
but
all right.
They were.
They were at one point.
they lived.
So, well done. There's those plugs on the electrical outlets.
Yes.
So when you're writing and you see aspects of your life, do you recognize those aspects bubbling up, these things like, oh, my gosh, this is part of my life that's entering into the plot? Do you recognize those, or is it much more that you're kind of in the stream of consciousness, that you're or in the zone, and it's only maybe later that you're saying, oh, this is something from my own life as well?
I think I almost always start with an autobiographical kernel,
mm-hmm.
Because that allows me to kind of breathe a certain kind of life into the into the world of the novel. I mean, there's nothing in the plot that is personal. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not a psychologist. My parents weren't murdered. You know, none of that stuff.
Right.
But having this kind of core, is really important to sort of breathing life into the world of the story. And I think that would be true even if I were writing Game of Thrones. I'd have some aspect in that world that I could go to as a touchstone so I could feel what the characters are feeling.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
I think that's true with acting too.
Yeah.
That you have to find some sort of corollary in your own life.
Yeah. There's different schools on the acting, but there's definitely this idea that find the correlating emotion. Can have nothing to do with the narrative, but the emotion is the same.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, for me, I think it's you know, like taking something that was really a huge part of, you know, the last little chunk of my life, which was the loss of my wife and sort of having to raise teenage kids as a single parent and feeling really crazy during big parts of that. It was something I wanted to write about, but not autobiographically. I wanted to find a really different world to place that feeling in so that I could actually, I feel like if I were trying to write it about it autobiographically, I'd be more self-protective,
mm-hmm.
and I'd also be more protective of my loved ones than I was in this world. I'm able to kind of let loose and, you know, let the evil winds blast them, which, yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that was important. That was an important part of my, of, you know, like a healing process to a certain extent.
I'm sure. I suppose that's, again, the sort of way that, that sometimes fiction is more honest or truthful than nonfiction.
Yeah. I mean, truthful is such a complicated
word. Yeah.
I mean, it's not ill will is not truthful to what really happened,
right?
But it's truthful to sort of like the exaggeration of feeling that I think we need. I mean, it's like, you know, when somebody is, you know, like writing a song and they really get to wail about this person that they lost or that this love that didn't turn out, that wailing is not necessarily what we do in our real life, but and when you get to do it in a song, that's the best thing ever.
Yeah, yeah. So you say it was therapeutic, the writing of it. Was it that wailing? Was it for you? Was it?
Oh, absolutely. But it was also this weird, dark laughter, which is another thing that you're not allowed to have. You know, like when you're a widower, you're not allowed to have this kind of like, oh, this is so screwed up. And there's that in this book too. I mean, I don't know whether I can claim that most readers will find this funny, but at least a few have.
Yes.
And there's a lot of passages where I was like chuckling sinisterly.
Yeah.
Is sinisterly a word?
It is now.
Okay.
You're a writer who just invented it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, I laughed out loud a couple of times, for sure. And the weird dark laughter is a brilliant way of describing it. You're listening to KUT's The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I am Owen Edgerton, and we're talking to Dan Shaun about his new novel, Ill Will. Dan, the novel is it's a mystery and it's a thriller. You've got a reputation, a well-deserved reputation, of being able to be in two worlds of genre and literary fiction simultaneously. Is that something you aim for? Or, I mean, when you were writing this, was there a nice aspect of like, I'm going to go for genre aspects here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's definitely something that is important to me for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think I was primarily a genre reader as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
That was the stuff that I loved the most.
Like who were you reading as a kid?
Stephen King, yeah. Ray Bradbury, Shirley Jackson, Peter Straub, I can't even remember the names of all of them, but
sure.
But during like the late 80s and early 90s, like every other bestseller was about a serial killer.
Yeah.
So I guess I felt like I came by this honestly, and it was something that it was a form that I loved. And, you know, at the same time, I knew I wanted to write about all these really personal things. And, you know, in that way, the form is a container.
Yeah.
It allows you to sort of create a structure, which is always hard for me. I mean, plot and structure is something that I struggle with.
Hmm.
And so genre has a really, like, built-in form to it. So it's almost like you've got a sonnet, and you know, you have to hit these marks.
Yeah.
And
it provides a certain freedom.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, and that's one of the things I love about genre. I'd like to try out all of the genres.
Yeah.
I'd like to do a Western. I'd like to do like a high fantasy novel. I want to do a spy thriller in, you know, like the Jean Le Carré mode.
That's fantastic.
So I'm hoping. I now, have to live long enough to do this.
You can do it.
Yeah.
I was reading somewhere, though, that when you're writing this, when you were well into the book, you're late in the process when you realized who your villain is.
Right.
Quote, unquote, villain is. So that surprised me, because it seems in the mystery world and thriller world, it seemed like you would... There would be so much outlining of like, okay, I'm going to be untying this knot, so I better know how to do that.
Right. I mean, I think for me, the first draft is always an exploratory draft, and it's important not to know what's going to happen.
You don't outline?
I don't outline at all. And then, you know in the back of your head that you have this form, you have this container, and that you have to hit certain marks. And then once you've gotten to it, you know, once you've gone through the entire first draft and discovered these things, then in the second draft you can go through and make things a little clearer and, you know, change things that need to be changed for the book to make sense.
Yeah.
Which I hope it does. It, you know, There's some debate about whether it makes complete sense or not. But, you know, I love the idea of not knowing and discovering as I go along, and also of coming to understand the characters in different ways as I go along. And without that, I'm not sure I'd be that interested in writing the book.
Yeah.
If I knew everything from the beginning, I think it would be less compelling to me.
Right. Like, how would you expect the reader to be discovering if you weren't discovering along
right.
the way?
Right.
That's interesting, because I know that you've been doing some screenwriting mm-hmm. as well, and including working on a limited series. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I write novels and screenplays, and I find there's an interesting thing in novels. In prose, I'm able to get lost,
mm-hmm.
and I can just write, and it's even the page allows for that, because there's, you know, the most I have to do is every now and then start a new paragraph.
Right.
In screenplays, I'm moving from setting to scene to dialogue, and there's and because of the nature of the current movie industry, there's much more structure involved.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, if you're not really following the save the cat thing, you're in trouble.
Yeah,
to some people at least,
right?
Like, where's the inciting incident? Is it on page 12?
And I'm totally guilty of that. I'm like, oh my God, what do I have to cut to get it to page 12 instead of page 13?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm. That's one of the reasons I'm kind of curious about trying out how this will feel in a limited series mode, because I feel like you have a little more freedom
yes.
in that than you do with a, you know, like a 90 or 120 minute film. Which I can't actually put my mind around how this would work as a like 120 minute screenplay.
Right.
I can much more imagine it over, you know, the course of 8 or 10 hours.
Yeah. Talking about structure, you write at night.
Yeah.
Is that? Do you still do that? Are you still a night writer?
Yeah. I could easily switch to early morning.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just that right now that's where my body clock is at. Mm-hmm. You know, and I started when I was taking care of little kids, because, you know, I'd get them down and then everything would be quiet, and I would have, you know, a little bit of time to hang out with my wife, and then she'd go to bed, and then I'd write till, you know, like till about 3 or 4 in the morning, and then I'd be able to get up with the kids and go on with my day.
Yeah.
But I think part of it for me is just this, you know, like needing to have a certain kind of silence and a certain kind of feeling that no one else is awake. And, you know, I mean, writers are really prone to distraction. You know, if I know somebody's awake in the house, I'll be tempted to go down and, you know, hang out with them or talk to them. And then, you know, that's breaking the, I mean, it's breaking the hypnotic state.
Yeah.
You know, even if somebody knocks,
yeah,
I'm screwed.
Yeah. Most certainly. But it's interesting. You listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know, you know, there's a number of writers who are like, oh gosh, no, silence or Beethoven.
Right.
But you listen to, like, Modest Mouse.
And... Right. I mean, part of it is that I start early on making a playlist.
I do this too. I love
And that, you know, the playlist is almost like a Pavlovian thing. I mean, I had this, you know, Modest Mouse song, Strangers to Ourselves, that starts, you know, that has kind of a martial boom. Boom, boom. And even now, if I hear that song, it's like I suddenly, like, I'm ready to write Ill Will. It's that Pavlovian for me. And it's not like, you know, like I'm really listening to the songs after mm-hmm. a while. I mean, if you listen to a playlist over and over, it becomes, you know, so much wallpaper that you're not even aware that it's there. But it gave me a timer for stuff. So I would have, you know, like... Usually the you know, it would be a 30-minute block, and that's a good block for me to write and then take a break.
Yeah.
So I'd have this timer. I'd write, you know, really without stopping, which is another problem for me. If I don't have a timer, then I, you know, will write one sentence, look out the window, check the internet.
Knowing there's a restraint.
Right.
Yeah.
But having that, but saying to myself, you have to write for 30 minutes, or, you know, this can't happen.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I just need that discipline, I've discovered. Or I can't write a novel because there's just too many words.
Right.
I mean, you also have to feed your subconscious to some extent. I mean, because I think that's the part of you that's like constantly like, hey, look at that. there's a butterfly.
Right. You give, like, it's like in meditation where you right. concentrate on the breathing.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, keeping yourself on task is one of the big challenges for me as a writer.
Oh gosh, me too. Where do you write? Like, what's your location?
I have a study, and it's on the third floor. It's in an attic, and I had this idea that I could not clean it until Ill Will was finished, and by the time the book was finally done, I just had to kind of like have somebody like with hazmat suits come in and trash everything and completely redo the place. But you know, it was literally like, you know, you had to like make a tunnel through the trash and stuff.
Dan, you have had a lot of success in the world of short stories. Mm-hmm. O. Henry Prize and gosh, I mean, almost every kind of prize that you can name, including the Academy Award for Literature. Is that right?
That's not associated with the American Academy. Yeah, it's the American Academy in Rome that gives out that prize.
I was like reading about that. I was like, this is fascinating. Are you thinking about like going back into the world of short stories at some point? It's like, or is it? Are you feeling like no, a next novel? I know you're working right now on the.
Well, I never really leave scripts. Short stories. I mean, I'm always sort of working on stories in between. Mm-hmm. There's a certain point when you're writing a novel that it requires your full attention. Everything in your life, everything that you write gets sucked into the novel in one way or another. But in the early process of writing a novel, you're thinking about that, then you write something that isn't going to fit into the novel, so you turn it into stories. I mean, I feel like I have a short story collection ready about once every 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's just because it takes a long time to finish a story, and it takes an even longer time to have 10 or 12 of them that you could put together into a collection.
Right.
So, you know, I may need to do another two novels before I have a collection.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure, but I'm still writing stories. I'm still publishing stories, and they're out there.
Yeah. So you can clean your office a little sooner with a story because you
finish.
Oh,
absolutely.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's important there too. And I imagine because you teach at Oberlin College in Ohio and you teach creative writing and I did an MFA program, and I found that the MFA programs almost by format sort of encourage short story writing.
Like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. At Oberlin, it's all undergrads, mm-hmm. So it is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And we do have classes in, you know, like writing novellas and writing you know, the short story cycle and things like that. But yeah, I mean the short story, and particularly for beginning students, like flash fiction or the short story or whatever you want to call it, is a really great teaching tool.
Yeah.
Because they can complete it, then you can really talk about it, then they can actually spend some time revising it, and they can produce a lot of them, which I think is the most important thing for a student to do, especially in the beginning. A beginning writer, I don't even want them to revise stuff. I just want them to write as, you know, as many things as they possibly can, and then, you know, leave it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then go back and see, is there anything that you think is worth going back to?
As opposed to trying to perfect the one.
Right, because, I mean, in most cases, that kind of revision is not possible at that age.
Yeah.
They just don't have enough behind them to do it.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, and it's, you know, and I think it makes them hate writing.
Mm, yeah, and I that makes a lot of sense. And do you approach that? I mean, you're mentioning with your first draft, you don't know necessarily where you're going. Is there an idea of like, let me just keep going, chapter, move on, page, and then later I'll understand more where I've been going, but not in that initial writing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the disadvantages of going through an MFA program, which, you know, there are lots of advantages, but one of the disadvantages is that you often leave with a murder of crows on your shoulder, and they all have something nasty to say whenever you write a sentence. And, you know, they're all smart people.
Yeah.
But, you write a sentence and one of them croaks, what a cliche. And then, you hear those voices all the time. And for me, you know, like all of these things, the timer, the free writing, the not knowing, are all ways to try to shut those crows up.
Yeah.
Because I could easily, you know, spend time working on the first paragraph of a novel and never get much beyond that. And I actually know people who are in that situation. You probably do too.
Yeah.
Where they would love to write a novel, but they're still stuck on that chapter one, and they go out and workshop that chapter, and then perfect it a little more.
Yeah, it's a bruised chapter after a while, and
and then they never get to the end.
No, and yeah, so it makes some sense. There's so many. I completely agree with you. You know, in improv, we often talk about, you know, just moving forward, and we say yes and is this improv term, but it's this idea of silencing the no-sayer in our brains, or, you know, the bouncer in your brain,
right?
Who's saying, no, that's a cliche. The crows,
right? I mean, it's like the drunk heckler.
Yeah,
who cares what they have to say? It's at a certain, you know, like if it's going to prevent you from doing your writing, then you have to just move past them.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking to Dan Shaun about his novel Ill Well, a novel that is haunting and mysterious. It's thrilling, and it has a nightmare logic to it that I wanted to ask you about. It's fascinating to have a mystery that unravels and you find these different pieces. Sometimes on some pages there are narratives in separate columns, and sometimes the narratives compete against each other. Often they complement each other. And in near the center of the novel, there's actually ghosts. There's the words of ghosts, which and these haunting locales. I wanted to ask you about nightmare logic,
mm-hmm.
And how that plays into writing something that also has to work as a nuts and bolts mystery.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that I was interested in when I started this was the idea that everybody has a different interpretation of events, and everybody has a different memory of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's particularly true when there's something traumatic and something that's, you know, got all these complicated emotions attached to it. And so I knew from the beginning that I wanted to have these five kids who were, you know, part of this big experience in the past, this murder of their family. And each one of them had a really different experience of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then to kind of unravel those side by side and see what happened. And I think that there is this kind of creeping thing that happens. These ghosts and these like almost devilish figures that appear and recur throughout the novel, that really felt to me like it expressed some of the uncanniness or the sense of fear in putting like narratives that each person believes side by side and seeing that they're not. I mean, I think that's a terrifying thing when you believe something so wholly and you put it side by side with somebody that experienced the same thing and they don't have the same experience at all.
Mm.
And it's something that happens to people all the time when you're, you know, at the Thanksgiving table and talking about, you know, somebody or some event in the past. There's all these outliers, memories that other people don't share. And what are those? Are those mistakes that you've made, or are they something that happened to you and not to other people? And if that's the case, how does that work?
Right.
I mean,
there is that. This sort of the novel falls into that. The idea that, gosh, there's several of ourselves, that we're not just one person. We're kind of experiencing several different aspects of life at one time.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's, I mean, that's an ordinary sort of thing. You know, we're certainly, you know, sitting here and looking at objects on a table, we're kind of trying to formulate what we're going to say next in the front of our mind, and in the back of our mind there's other things that we're thinking about, like, where's a good place to eat around here? So that, you know, we all are walking in those columns, right? I mean, the side-by-side columns where there are, you know, three of us or more, probably more, walking in the same body.
Yeah. And I suppose one of the powers of being a talented novelist is the ability to maybe even step into one fully and then step out of another one and step into that one fully.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, with that too, I wanted to ask you, we're nearing the end, but I wanted to ask you about the Satanic Panic.
Okay.
Because that is a sort of brilliant cultural example of what you're talking about on the individual, about two people sharing at a dinner table going, well, you remember this, but no, this happened. And on the Satanic Panic, which we have some incredibly dark stories that happened here in Austin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
People,
yeah,
wrongly convicted. That is an amazing aspect of sort of cultural, what would you call it? Invention?
Well, I mean, it's called a moral panic, or you know, a mass hysteria. And I think, to me, the part of it had to do with people coming to realize that childhood abuse, and particularly sexual abuse, was happening.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it was so hard for us to get our minds around the idea that this was happening inside of families. That we would rather have believed that there was, you know, a whole gang of hooded cultists who were doing this, as opposed to believing that, you know, somebody's parent would do it to them. And I mean, I think as we came to accept that, yes, these kinds of things mostly happen within families and with people that we know, and, you know, as opposed to happening with strangers, that idea of, you know, a satanic cult became less important. But originally it was sort of a placeholder so that we could wrap our minds around this idea, mm-hmm. which at the time was really a radical and shocking idea.
Yeah. Oh, I remember it quite clearly. Like, it was clear that there are cults. Mm-hmm. Like, it was scary and like, oh my gosh, how did we not know this? But now it's fact.
Right.
That's
right.
What we believed. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like, you know, it's not that unusual in American culture for us to believe in pretty crazy things. I mean, you can find plenty of people that...
Any examples in recent history?
Well, I mean, yes, of course, of course. And, you know, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But I mean, we can go back to, you know, the commie hysteria of the 1950s, right. Or, you know, the fairly still widely held belief that there was no moon landing.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there's still incredibly insane things that people believe.
Gosh, yeah, we had Pizzagate, goodness, yeah.
Which feels like that came right out of my novel.
It really does. The timing of your novel is frighteningly
I didn't really
perfect.
Want that.
No, of course not. I don't think a lot of us did.
Right.
Dan, would you be willing to read like a page or two?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Section? Would that be right?
Yeah. Sometimes a dead bird is just a dead bird. His wife told him that back when they were first dating. They had been walking together along the main street of town, holding hands. It was the first time that they had held hands. And when their fingers clasped, she looked at him and raised her eyebrows and grinned. And then a robin fell on the sidewalk right in front of them. Apparently it fell out of the sky. Possibly a bird of prey had accidentally dropped it, they decided later. But at the moment, they were both astonished. They stood staring at the limp body and their handhold fell away. Fuck, Jill said, and then, without another word, she grabbed his hand up again and held it tightly. Listen, she said fiercely, it's nothing. Sometimes a dead bird is just a dead bird. Which he had always remembered. It was one of those little private phrases that married people take up and repeat to one another. It had become a mantra for him. though Jill had no idea that it was also an anecdote that he sometimes told his patients, one of those humorous but poignant personal stories that you introduce to help build trust, etc. "Sometimes a dead bird is just a dead bird," he would say. "When Jill told me that, I felt something kind of unlock inside me." And he'd look at the patient, thoughtful, puzzled for a moment. "I realized," he'd say, "I realized that I had the choice. I could give the moment a meaning, or I could choose to ignore it. It just depended on the kind of story I wanted to tell myself." He could feel himself smiling earnestly as if he'd never thought of this before. "We are always telling a story to ourselves, about ourselves," he'd say. Sometimes he would make a gesture that was almost like a touch, though he actually rarely made skin-to-skin contact. "But we can control those stories," he'd say. "I believe that. Events in our life have meaning because we choose to give it to them."
That was Dan Shaun reading from his new novel, Ill Will. Dan, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to KUT's The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I'm Owen Edgerton. Today, our producer and engineer was Rebecca McEnroy. And our... Felix, what's your new title?
Ambassador of Buzz.
And our Ambassador of Buzz, Felix Morgan. Keep reading, keep tuning in, and thanks for listening.